For me, light has always been a language, a way to interact and create a relationship with yourself, with the people around you, with the world around you. But the way we treat light is quite brutal. So more than 83% of the world population does not see the stars anymore.
This is Dan Rosegaard talking about his passion for light, something that beams through his engaging global projects, which address the climate crisis and how we can learn from nature to create a better tomorrow. Dan is a Dutch artist and founder of social design lab Studio Rosegaard. You're listening to Create Tomorrow with me, Bethan Ryder, editorial director of WGSN. And today I'm joined by our director of strategic forecasting, Lisa White, who's my co-host for our chat with Dan. And she's a fellow enthusiast for throwing a spotlight on nocturnal living. To kick off the discussion, I asked Dan where in the world he was and what he's up to.
We're in Indonesia, where we're designing and building actually the world's largest firefly gardens. So fireflies were everywhere here 20 years ago, all wiped out because of light pollution and pesticides. So we're breeding them and trying to bring them back.
I'm going to hand over to Lisa. I think Lisa wants to kick off with the first question for you, Dan.
I wanted to give a bit of background as well, too, about why we're having this conversation. And at WGSN, we've been tracking how climate change will impact everything: society, technology, politics, industry, creativity. And the environment's always impacted people's ways of living. But with hotter weather happening globally, we're looking at the important shift towards nocturnal living, which works well with those fireflies. And that means that people will be moving many more activities that have previously been done during the day to cooler, cleaner times of the evening and night. So we're seeing night swimming in Dubai, night coffee shops in China, wellness nightclubs, and people being out in nature, wanting to discover the beauty of the night, which is also much more difficult to do with the light pollution you were talking about. So my question for you, Dan, is so much of your work brings the night to life. And I wanted to know, why did you decide to focus on nighttime design in a major part of your work?
I think it started with that in the beginning, I was a bit scared of the night, right? I was a bit scared of the darkness because it's something that really plugs into your instinct, you know, like you lose a sense of control. And I sort of got fascinated with that. So what I started to do, I started to go night diving in tropical Asia. And it's this weird sensation when you drop your body into the cold ocean and you go down, 5, 6, 7, 10, 15 meters. You lose a sense of control. You lose a sense of everything, basically. And your brain is sort of saying, get out of there, right? But once you surrender and you realize, hey, you're just part of that system somehow, and statistically, no sharks should be present, you move your hands and suddenly there's light. There was the glowing algae, the plankton, a 700 million year old microorganism. And I just got really excited. Going up above the water, you see the sky opening up, the stars, and you realize that although the stars are far, far away and speeding towards us, 300,000 kilometers per second, the light, the microalgae, which are also very old, are somehow weirdly connected in an intuitive way. And I'm sort of in between. But also, like what you address, as populations are growing in certain places, when you talk about tourism, Athens, Dubai, you name it, are getting overcrowded and sort of almost brutalized by the well-intended visitor, it could be interesting to extend it to an evening and a night experience to give a different atmosphere, a different experience, but also just to raise the capacity of certain places.
That's true. And then maybe even modify people's relationship to the night, because people tend to think about the night as either you're supposed to be sleeping or you're supposed to be out partying. And the idea of being out in nature and experience it in that more awe-inspiring way, because, you know, we're used to the day. We're not used to nature at night.
Dan, in your work, we talk a lot about the move to this multi-species thinking and away from anthropomorphic man as the dominant species. I just wondered, is that part of the message you want to bring to your clients and your audiences? What do you feel unifies your work and that you're trying to sort of make people feel when, because it's a very emotive, your work.
You know, for me, light has always been a language, a way to interact and create a relationship with yourself, with the people around you, with the world around you. But the way we treat light is quite brutal. So more than 83% of the world population does not see the stars anymore. Only since 20 years, right? Why? Because we've just been sort of like, if streetlights would be in conversation, it would just be me doing blah, 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 all the time, right? Yeah, noise. And so I think we need to sort of curate the way we treat light and darkness in cities, but also surrounding. And I remember when we did the second city of Seeing Stars, where we convinced the city of Leiden, which is a big city nearby Amsterdam, and we convinced the mayor to switch off all the lights for an hour and a half to bring back the stars. And to be honest, we were standing on the rooftop. It was like a year preparation, right? UNESCO collaborated, saying everybody should have the right to see the stars, right? So these are big teamworks. But we're standing on the rooftop of the city hall 1 minute before 10 o'clock, they would switch the light. And my PA, it was like our first week, she was new. And we're like, are they really going to do this, right? Are we really getting away with it? And all the lights were switched off. And you could see parts of the Milky Way in those city streets. And we had tens of thousands of people going outside, seeing the stars. Some people let the light on, and then people would ring the doorbell like, hey, switch off the light. So everybody started to whisper. And I thought that was really fascinating because as a designer, right, as a creator, I'm so used to add to take control. But here you sort of remove, right? I didn't design those stars, right? That's sort of obvious. but I remove and therefore I reveal. So it also requires indeed what you just said, a sort of more humble approach where you try to find a new sense of harmony and you got to design for that. Yeah. But it requires a different strategy than how I was operating 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, we often say that nature is the world's first technology, and we need to recognize that. And like you said, give nature the center stage.
With Spark, Dan, you updated fireworks to create an organic biophilic version of them, which brought a lot of poetry to the night again. And I wondered, I mean, I feel like it is central sustainability right to your process, but I wondered how much it is and how you think about each project in that respect.
Well, it was interesting. In 2008, we were designing the first sustainable dance floor, a floor which would generate energy when you dance on it. And that was sort of the first time. What I found interesting about that project and working on it was that suddenly sustainability was about doing more, right? Instead of about doing less. So yeah, we need less cars and less airplanes and less meat, sure. But we also need to do more, a lot more. And I miss that in the world of today, that conversation, right? And so that's when sort of sustainability start becoming into our mindset. And so when you look at Spark, I think we can all after COVID agree the importance of celebrations, right? And coming together and feeling a connection. I somehow feel we've started to cherish that even more and more. But when you look at celebration, when you look at traditional firework, it can be pretty cool, but increase 10 times in air pollution. You know, my dog goes completely crazy, all the dogs and the animals and the birds. And so you can sort of look at it and say, like, if it does that much harm, can you still call that celebration, right? And so you start to think about how can we keep the tradition but modernize it. And so if I fast forward 2 years later, we launched indeed Spark, which is silent, which I love about it. Tens of thousands of biodegradable sort of floatables, bubbles that reflect and absorb the light, creating this huge cloud of ever-changing light. And we run it for a couple of hours. You can walk through it, all biodegradable. We've done Bilbao, London, Melbourne, Auckland, just Tokyo with Hermes. We're doing Italy end of March. Everybody's welcome. And yeah, it's a beautiful example of how I believe we should use beauty as a strategy to help people accept change, climate change. You mentioned in the introduction, because we all need to change and nobody wants to change and climate change, right? And so we're sort of stuck, especially Europe. We're sort of stuck. And I think using beauty as a strategy to help people open up, beauty is something amazing. Like you look at something, you don't really understand it or get it, but you want to know, right? Like a beautiful girl or boy in a discotheque, right? Like you're curious, you're open up. And I feel we should use that more and more to help people to accept change. That's something that fascinates me personally.
Yeah, that's one thing I really love about your work, because you develop a lot of win-wins. And Grow, for example, is a light installation that you created that elevates agricultural land to become an artwork without losing sight of the main function to help better produce food, since that combination of red, blue, and ultraviolet light enhances plant growth and reduces the need for pesticides. With all the challenges that the world is facing, do you see more win-wins? And do you see the future as a utopia, a dystopia, or a protopia, more or less?
I create for two reasons, for the we and the me. I feel what I do contribute to hopefully something better for society, the we. I do it for me to keep myself sane, to feel still connected. Because no, but seriously, you look outside the window, you go a bit crazy, right? You have COVID, traffic jam, air pollution, crazy fireworks, you know, it's just, it's very confusing, the world. And the younger generation is feeling that anxiety. That's a real thing. They sort of, my students say our future is frozen. We're inheriting all the global challenges. We're not getting the toolkit to fix it, right? So now what? And I think that's sad, but it's real. So am I positive about the future? No. But somehow that is a trigger to create and to make proposals and to try to do better. And that's what I can do. I think a good idea is uncomfortable. Like it's funny, I was talking about it today with the design team. Like when we're working on a new project, you have some of these ideas and they're uncomfortable. They're sort of like, ugh. But they're sort of, but also like, oh, right? They have this duality in it. I don't know how to explain that. And it's sort of like this itch that you cannot scratch. And that's interesting. And especially in the world of today where uncomfortableness is highly being avoided, right? In the media and how we talk to each other. And it's like, oh, like, and I think that's a problem. That's a real problem because the beauty comes from uncomfortableness and you somehow deal with it. So yeah, many disasters, but somehow the failure always becomes sort of food. And I remember when we were building the smog-free towers, the huge vacuum cleaners making clean air parks, and we had requests from mayors all around the world. It was a famous project, but we were broke as ever because what's the price of clean air, right? And we live in a world where to pollute is for free, right? So what's the model there? And then like that was sort of like we were stuck, like it was a disaster. And then we had buckets of smog particles in our studio from Beijing and India and Rotterdam. And we were looking at it and we're like, okay, but if waste does not exist in this new world, what can we do with it? 42-48% was carbon. Carbon on high pressure, we made diamonds, jewelry. And so by sharing a smog-free ring, you donate 1,000 cubic meter of clean air. And so the finance, the funding we made with the jewelry, with the Kickstarter campaign, helped to raise money to build more towers. And that was sort of like, wow. But that was a disastrous moment, but it somehow triggered us to look at the world in a different way. And that changed everything.
Exactly. It's constant change. And one of the things you wanted to bring up as well, too, the big topic right now on everybody's lips is AI. And we're just curious to see how your studio works with AI and is what excites you about it and what maybe frightens you about it.
Well, I mean, like in any kind of tool, you can do good and bad. But when you look at the Midjourney and all the text to images, I'm just here in Indonesia with my laptop talking with robots, right? Feeding them, they're feeding me. I send it to the printer, which prints it out for €2 and frames it, and ships it the same day here. I hang it on my wall. That sounds like the beginning of a good science fiction movie, right? So I've always seen it as a great tool to experiment because the only limitation is your imagination. So what we do in the studio is we have the ideas, we visualize it, then we build a prototype, make it real. Like I don't care about all digital only, like make it real. We take photos of that prototype. We upload it again in something like Midjourney, work on it. So there's this constant switch between digital and physical, trying to make it become a reality. So I think it's a great tool. I think it also pushes us humans to be more human, right? Because they are taking over. They are getting smarter. So the real question here is, do we become robot food? Or do we realize that we as humans, creativity is our true capital? And the more we invest in that, the more we rebalance. In a way, we're forced to be creative again, right? And a lot of people don't like that. And a lot of things have changed and are changing. But I find it, again, uncomfortable. And yeah, maybe that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. I mean, we talk about creativity as being one of the cornerstones of methodology of our forecasting as well, too. And we speak of strategic imagination, and that's something that we're going to need for the future.
Oh, yeah. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, strategic imagination is taking creativity, but putting it in a business sense. So if you talk to a CEO about you need to be more creative, most of them will say, well, no, I just need to make sure that, you know, we're pushing our business forward, making money for shareholders. But when you frame it as strategic imagination, is you need to imagine what's going to happen if you do X, Y, or Z, get a bit of a speculative spin on it, then they're like, oh, I can see why I need to be thinking maybe 2 years, 5 years, actually 10 years in advance to be able to plan what's going to happen. Because the future is here right now, and it's changing so quickly.
Yeah, and if you cannot imagine it, you can also not create it, right? And I find that very sort of challenging of the world of today. Okay, so when we talk about that future and the climate change, look at the words that we're using and our governments are using. Carbon neutral, energy neutral, 5% less worse. So imagine you're dating somebody, right? Boy, girl, whomever. Well, like, imagine you're dating somebody and you say, love of my life, this year we're going to be neutral. This year, we're going to do it 5%. I hope that person will dump me on the spot, right? That's a bad relationship. But this is how we describe our relationship with our future, with our planet. And so it starts. And don't ever underestimate the power of words and the vision they create in our head. So I think it's our job as creative people in the widened sense of the word. That can be designer, architect, artist, or CEO, or whomever, to imagine that better world in order so that we can create it.
We've been talking about embracing uncertainty too, because what people want is certainty. You know, as you said, a lot of people are anxious and they just want to be able to count on something or a few somethings. But getting them comfortable with the idea of uncertainty and serendipity, and the work that you do is very awe-inspiring that way. And when you are in touch with nature and with serendipity, you're like, wow, there's something bigger out there that I can maybe put my trust in. And that bigger thing is oftentimes nature.
Absolutely. And I've been working with, like, if we would have this interview 10 years ago, I would have talked about my self-developed microchips and C++ code and our new LED. I don't do that anymore. Now I talk about fireflies or the wing of a butterfly, how it reflects light, you know, like, so I changed. And when you work with nature, you don't create. Like, God creates, right? You just modify. You just sort of, you learn how to tweak and tune and, oh, works, doesn't work. And you get to know a system. And I find that fascinating.
You're listening to the WGSN Create Tomorrow podcast. And in this episode, we're talking about the rise of nocturnal living and also how nature can teach us how to create a better tomorrow. I'm Bethan Ryder, Director of Editorial at WGSN, and I'm joined by my co-host, Director of Strategic Forecasting here, Lisa White. And our guest today is the Dutch artist, Dan Rosegaard. Dan, I know you often work with NASA. Can you talk a little bit about what you do with them? And also, I'd love to hear your views on space exploration more generally.
Yeah, well, right now there's more than 8.1 million kilo of space junk. Started with Sputnik, Apollo, pieces of satellites and missiles. Were launched and started to collide, creating this layer of junk around our Earth. And the famous space scientist Kessler calculated that in 2030, there's so much junk around our Earth, and it's sort of concentrated, right? Because there are sort of highways where these things happen, that anything we will launch will be get hit, create collision, create more junk, right? So that will be the, sort of the point of no return. So we will have an interview in a couple of years and say, hey, we found life outside Earth or this really interesting material. The problem is we won't get there. So that's a problem. And it's like exactly what you said. We're not satisfied ruining our oceans. We also got to pollute this space. And it's a problem because it's everything. It's our communication, our WhatsApp, our data. And so we launched together with ESA, the European Space Agency, the Space Waste Lab, where we try to visualize, capture, and upcycle space junk to sort of see, first of all, raise awareness about it, but also secondly, hey, maybe it's not waste. Maybe like the smoke-free ring, it's a tool that we can use to create something better. Super urgent topic that is sort of in the big white elephant in the room that we try to unsee. But yeah, it's there.
You founded your studio in 2007. Do you feel like you are now being listened to? Obviously, you've worked with whole towns and switched lights off. Do you feel like governments are listening to you? You have influence. How much impact do you feel you're able to have beyond like people that are just an audience, which I'm not saying just an audience, but in terms of like at that sort of policy level, at that level of real legislative change?
Yeah, I mean, when I go to a fine art school, I see our previous work, you know, printed out in black and white on shitty papers hanging on the wall. And it's sort of cool that we became part of the mental map, you know, of this sort of flow. When I was 16, I walked into a museum. I didn't know what to do, right? I didn't want to go. My teachers made me go there. And I was just this stubborn, wise-ass guy with too many crazy ideas. And everybody was really worried about me. And I saw the work of Arata Isozaki, Japanese architect. And I was like, whoa, I can create my own world. I didn't know. I didn't know architecture was a profession, right? How should I know? And it changed me and it inspired me. And I got a chance to meet him and talk to him and tell him this story. And so it's great to feel that we're inspiring people. But at the same time, on a personal level, the answer would be no. Because I feel when I can do more, I want to do more, right? So I'm going to push it. So I'm going to present, if I present a beautiful idea, a beautiful, radical, innovative idea, and everybody in that room with mayors or CEOs or whomever agrees it's a great, beautiful idea, it's not a radical idea, right? So yeah, I get appreciated and a sort of respect, but at the same time, I also use that capital to sort of say that people say, Dan, we're not doing this. This is just no. And then usually they call back in 2 years and do it anyway. So it takes some time.
What is the radical idea that is exciting you right now? What would you like to do next?
I would love to find a way to make places cooler. And I don't mean this in the too cool for school way, but like literally cooler, like cooling down. Like, is there a way to, you know, reduce temperature 5 to 8 degrees in the evening? Things get hotter. That's a real, without air conditioning and all the electricity, like in a passive way. You know, nature and the plants are doing it in such a smart way. What can we learn from that? There's so many things. I think what I love about ideas is that they bring me to a place that I've never been before. Sometimes people say, I have an idea, right? I have an idea. And I think that's not true. I don't think you own an idea. I think you surrender to an idea. Like, and so that's what I'm doing. I'm now, but literally, like, I am, again, Kevin Kelly, out of control. Really good book, by the way. Please read it. Or in co-control, and you feed it with your love, your time, your energy, the teamwork, of course, and the experts. And it brings you to a place that you're like, ah. And, you know, there's this one moment where we're walking through the streets of Leiden after switching off the light. I'm still getting goosebumps just talking about it. And, you know, everybody's whispering and it sort of actually worked and the clouds were sort of gone. Thank God for that, right? So I was, but anyway, and you're sort of walking there. And you feel it, you know, it's an experience and everybody feels it. And it changed the way people thought about light and about their city. When I design a firefly garden, every time I'm designing, I have to look through the eyes of a firefly and ask me, what does it want? What does it need? So I'm designing for them, not for me. And that's so much fun.
I've got goosebumps just thinking about that. So that's already an experience in itself.
But it's crazy, like a firefly larvae, an egg, 9 to 12 months before it becomes a firefly. Firefly lives 22 days, same like a butterfly. So it's like, so we're having somebody being hand-fed the larvae with mealworms every day. But you're right, like looking at them makes me happy. And it's also interesting, like if you look at my screen right now, like if I have a firefly and I do this with my phone, the flashing of my light, they come to me. Because light is their language, right? They use it to, and so I'm talking with light, which is my language, with nature. And of course, I have no idea what I'm saying, right? Maybe I'm insulting them because I don't speak fireflies yet. I will one day. But so when you talk about what you started with this evening experience and the night experience, that sense of intimacy, that sense of a real connection in this AI blockchain over digitalized world, I think there will be a new desire for like real experiences that trigger you in a different way. And it's out there. It's we already got it. That's the post-screen area we're going to live in.
Dan, just to end, I'd love to hear if you could describe the Firefly Garden just so listeners could really understand what the immersive experience will be for people when they experience it.
So the biggest part is the nursery, where we're growing, feeding, nurturing them, making sure they don't get eaten by geckos and frogs and all that stuff. So that's a big chunk. But then you have the garden, a big dome, 3,000-4,000 square meter with thousands of fireflies. I want to place a table for two, right? So you can have dinner with the fireflies, just one table.
Thanks to my colleague, Lisa White, and our guest, Dan Roosegaard, for joining me today. If you want to follow Dan's innovations, check out his website, studioroosegaard.com. And do look out for Spark, which is lighting up the Italian city of Pesaro this March. If you're a WGSN subscriber, you'll find reports covering nocturnal living across the site on every platform. Plus, there's an informative webinar presented by Lisa White on this topic. Head over to WGSN.com to discover how you can subscribe to our service. We're constantly publishing new content focusing on how we can design a brighter, better future for all of our industries, and these include food and drink, interiors, beauty, fashion, and consumer tech. We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode, and you can catch the CEO of WGSN, Carly Buzashi, next week on our other podcast, Lives of Tomorrow.